This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Con Fringe reading series.
Alrighty, it's time to get started on the final part of the evening, where we torture our beloved readers with interesting questions. And I guess we should probably start with Will, and a huge apology for my having stuffed up on some of the recording. I have no idea at the moment how much of your stuff we've got, but just in case we haven't got any of it, do you want to give us some impromptu poetry or something?
Death approaches, a rose between her teeth. Her black cloaked gown gapes open. Is it an invitation or in threat? Her hand is offered in it, and a decision must be made. Perhaps another time, she says, and departs.
How about that?
Honestly, I'm a really cheerful person normally.
I don't know, I stuff up on the recording and ask him for some poetry, and he starts talking about death. A bit scary, if you ask me.
So, go on, questions then. Questions. Anyone got a question?
No. It's my turn. I got to think of a question. The fact that I have no brain is entirely beside the matter. The two things that you do, the horror stories and the dark fantasy, they're really quite a different end of the spectrum, one of which is entirely creepy, the other of which is quite silly. How did you end up with these two very, very different forms?
Well, the silliness, I'm afraid, is sort of like ingrained. I can't help it. But as for the horror, I joined a small poetry collective, and they wanted me to do the dark stuff. I'd already written The Showing, which really is actually part of my family history. There's a section in The Showing where a policeman character is talking to the main character, and the main character says to the policeman that when he was six and he hadn't wanted to go to the house, to his grandfather's house, his mother had said to him, "It can't hurt you. You've got your grandfather's blood," which is quite a scary implication. Now, my mother actually said that to me about my grandfather's house when I was refusing to go there when I was six. Afterwards, she always denied it. But you're not going to really make that up at age six, and nor are you ever really going to forget it for the rest of your life. So the horror and the dark stuff just started to come out. But in the end, it's all the same thing, isn't it? As writers, our job is to entertain. And it doesn't matter whether you're telling jokes, whether you're telling horror, whether you're doing soap opera, which I wish I could do, but I can't. I mean, space soap opera, sorry. I really wish I could write that, but I just can't and make it viable. We're there to entertain an audience. And the genre is a bit immaterial, really, isn't it?
I can understand why spiders are scary. I can understand why, tentacle beings from beyond the stars are scary. I haven't quite worked out why houses are scary, and yet so many people seem to write stories about scary houses. Where does it come from?
Well, it's the setting. If you want to scare somebody, there's two ways to do it. Either you can go, and a monster jumps out and gets you with big tentacles or eight legs and some tiny teeth, and it just sort of trickles down your arm like that. Or you can go for what I prefer to do, which is tension and the creep factor. And there is nothing creepier than an old, empty house, is there? Which creaks in strange places. You're not used to it. You've not stayed in it. When you live in your house, you're used to the noises your house makes at night. And you don't hear them anymore, do you? You're used to the fact the boiler might fire up at a particular time, or the radiators might gurgle occasionally. You're used to these noises. When you're in a strange house and it makes its quiet, settling noises at night, you're not used to those, so they are unsettling. And that's what's nice about an old, empty house. You can't get comfortable in it.
That's my bed you're talking about. Alrighty. Moving on to Gareth, you had a rather different sort of scary, a very, very traditional scary, the thing which sort of appears and grabs somebody and then they're gone before you even notice that they're not there. Space opera, it has to have tentacles in it, right?
Yes. squids from beyond the stars.
Yeah, gotta have a squid.
There is no answer to that question other than yes. So the space opera has to have squid. Space opera also seems to have intergalactic war. That, you know, clearly this book is set after some incredibly catastrophic war, sort of thing that occasionally turned up in banks. So what's the function of that? Is it sort of collapse of civilization type thing? Does it give you desolated places to explore or what?
There are a couple of answers to that, really. The first one is that sometimes it's really cool to see enormous big things going very fast, blowing the crap out of other big things. And the other one is in this book, the trouble dog, the ship, is sentient, and she's aware. Her brain was actually cloned from the stem cells taken from a dying soldier on another planet in a previous war before the last one. And after the war, all these ships and these soldiers who participated in this horrible war crime that was alluded to in the first chapter, they leave their respective militaries and they all end up working for this organisation called the House of Reclamation, whose job, they're kind of like an interstellar AA. If your ship breaks down, they'll pop over and save your life and take you back. But through it all, you have people who are on different sides of the conflict working together in the same ship, trying to save life instead of taking it, and trying to work through what they've done and process who they are. And then you have other characters who are all too aware of what they've done, maybe hiding it and pretending to be other people.
Okay, well, I certainly hope we get to read this book at some time. I mean, the first couple of chapters definitely grabbed me. By the way, I did notice that when you were talking about the trouble dog being sentient, you were gazing down at Lyra, who's fast asleep at your feet.
I was trying not to step on that.
Well, yes, it wouldn't do to actually step on the dog. Okay. So has anybody else got any questions for our audience while I desperately try to think of some more? Stark?
This one for Gareth. Writing brand new space opera, did you feel like this sort of feeling of absolute creative license to do anything, or were you really intimidated about starting something completely from scratch and building a whole universe?
The first one. It was brilliant. It's so much fun. I'd written, after the Three Monkey books, where, you know, which are set more or less in the present day with a bit of extra technology and having to get things right and doing research about Spitfire cockpits and Zeppelins. And it was brilliant. Exciting to see. Right, they get in the spaceship and away we go. And yeah, it was just like coming home. It was absolutely, I can do anything I want as fast as I want and blow it up as much as I want. It's just, it was, you know, it's space opera to me is my playground. It's what I grew up imagining and pretending, and I could just write it for ever, I think, and I'm probably going to try.
Tom.
Hello, lurking in the background. This is initially for Gareth, but I suppose Will can answer it as well, because it's a conceptual one. With your excerpt you read tonight, Gareth, it's very vivid characters, very, you know, sort of with both chapters, I really felt, you know, unique voices, which was great, and clearly a very well-imagined world. And you say how much you love space opera. I was just wondering what came, you know, it's a bit of a chicken and egg, which came first? Was it the characters? Was there a real character that linked you into starting the story? Or was it the world? Was there something about this galaxy, this sort of scenario that sort of, you know, can you remember what really sort of sparked the imagination on this one?
Oh, this is going to sound very odd, but the thing that kicked this off was an article I read by Clarkson. I was in a dentist's waiting room and I picked up a book and flicked through it. There's an article in there he wrote about the Titanic, and he wrote about the fact that before the Titanic, lots of liners had gone down, but we'd just never known about it because they didn't have radios. They just hadn't shown up, and after a month or so, people would shrug and say, oh, well, I guess they're dead then. But when the Titanic went down, and he was putting in context that going down in that part of the Atlantic, in those days, you might as well have crashed into the far side of the moon, because it was very unlikely anyone could get to you. And the radio made it possible for nearby ships to come to their aid and scoop up a few people. And I started thinking about, well, if you had a space opera where it was kind of travel between worlds was sort of analogous to the difficulty of traveling between Europe and America in the days of the Titanic, then maybe if there was a rescue organisation that could come and rescue these ships. And that it kind of kicked off from there, really. And I don't know where the characters came from, because they arrived straight away afterwards. And the first one to pop in was the Trouble Dog herself, the spaceship. Because I thought, if I'm going to have a rescue organisation, I need a ship with a motivation to actually go out and rescue people. And then the rest of them came from there, really. But yeah, it's a strange place to find an idea, but that's where it came from.
What fascinates me, largely, is the idea that a separate world or another world can exist very, very close to ours, so close it touches. And what I like to do is to try and live in the crack between the two and explore in various ways the way in which perhaps the supernatural world or the fantasy world actually touches ours and can combine with it. When I started writing the comic fantasy series, I'd just been reading quite a bit of high fantasy. And I'd read all the usual tropes where the dispossessed heir meets a small group of people who are going to go with him on a quest, and they will all turn out to be excellent with the swords, or they're magic users, or they're thieves, or perhaps you've got the priest, or something like that. And I thought, wouldn't it be good if instead of that he met a rock and roll band? And that led me to another benefit. Because if you're going to research high fantasy, then you're going to wind up in strange places, looking into deep valleys, perhaps researching, as I know Sophie has done, high mountains in New Zealand. Whereas I tend to spend most of my research time listening to loud music in smoky bars and drinking beer. I sometimes think I've rather got the better end of the deal there. And as far as the supernatural is concerned, again, it's just the cracks between the worlds that I like. And the characters come along, and the ideas come with the characters then. A lot of my horror stuff, the paranormal, actually starts as flash fiction. And I'll write a small piece, up to 1,000 words. Sometimes it's just the prologue, maybe it's just a section that just kicks off the whole idea and allows me to develop it from the characters, from that single piece of flash fiction. Often, I have to say, from a bad dream after eating too much cheese at night.
And if they're going to meet a rock and roll band in this fantasy world, I think it's probably entirely appropriate that the bass player is a dragon.
And a drunken one at that.
All rock and roll bands are drunken, Will. There's no question about that. Oh dear. Gareth, your lady poetess fascinates me because, I mean, a lot of us here try to write and we scribble away and scribble away and desperately try to find something worth publishing, and then finally maybe somebody gets to buy one of our stories and we're as proud as punch about it. And yet here you have a character who has had enormous literary success and thinks that, well, what she's written is complete and utter rubbish. Where does this one come from?
The mirror. No, it's I don't want to give too much away, but she's not who she appears to be, and the identity she has at the moment is an assumed identity. So accidentally becoming famous was very much not her game plan. But yes, I haven't written any poems to go in the book though. I only know one poem, and it's as. I like cheddar cheese. I like scrumpy. Somerset's quite flat, but the Mendips make it lumpy.
Yeah, If you want some really bad poetry, I could write it for you. Justin, you'll have to come over here to ask the question.
I wonder if I can ask you about the structure of those two chapters. Because you had a really good opening chapter with lots of action in the first chapter, which is kind of what you'd expect for a novel. Grab the reader. Great. Second chapter, completely different. It's almost like in a symphony, you've gone for the very quiet repose, except for the very last bit, where you shove in a whole load of action. And I'm thinking, where did that come from? You know, almost if you hadn't had that section at the end of the second chapter, you could almost have that as a prologue or an epilogue, because it's completely different frequency to the first chapter. So I don't know, what were your thoughts on that? Because also the other thing I thought was, did you consider in the second chapter bringing in the action slowly, drip feeding it, rather than having it a lump at the end? Because it kind of felt a bit that way. I don't want to criticise, but just be really interested to know your structural thoughts on that.
Actually, there is a prologue before those first chapters, which is the final battle of the war, is the prologue, and the part some of the play in this atrocious war crime that takes place. And then chapter one is 3 years after that. So yeah, in chapter one, it starts off, but I'm introducing four narrative voices. So after chapter two, you have chapter three, which is another character again, and then chapter four, which is a fourth character, and then it loops back to the first one again. And their stories, they build up slowly. So you have the action at the beginning there, then I'm introducing the second character, who is somewhat taken by surprise. And then her ship is taken down, and the Trouble Dog and company have to go out to find it and rescue the people on board. So from a structural point of view, it starts with the rescue at the beginning, then you have the interstellar mugging in chapter two, and then from there on it comes. I tried to do it like Miles Davis and John Coltrane, where they kind of loop in the saxophone and the trumpet sort of twining in between each other, so that you get sort of riffs going, and then the other voices will come in and kind of partly echo it but do something else all the way through. I don't know if you could tell that by reading it at all. I don't think you probably could, but that's kind of what I was thinking of when I was writing it.
I like the sudden panic, because it really is the way that space works, that you're in this thing and you're progressing through the void and everything is kind of normal, and just one event and suddenly it can be total and utter panic, because you've only got seconds in order to keep yourself alive.
And one thing I learned from writing the Monkey Books as well is end every single chapter on a cliffhanger.
Yeah, somebody else has been reading George Martin. Talking of space opera, who out here has been watching The Expanse? Nobody? Oh, dear, oh my. Yeah. I mean, some of you will have read Leviathan Wakes because it was up for a Hugo, and maybe have read the others as well. But The Expanse TV series, absolutely brilliant. And it's only about 17 quid to buy it on Google Play, so well recommended. Anyway, anybody got any more stories or questions or things? More impromptu poetry? Sorry, I'm putting him on the spot. Yeah, Gareth.
The public loo costs 20p, but it's free to pee behind a tree.
A love poem, then. She sits in between the here and now, in between the was and is. She regards, in turn, that which may be and that which may not be. Turning, she turns from east to west, through north and south, and turns again. Impassive, she sits in between the here and now.
Lovely. So, do we have any more questions for either of our two readers? tonight. Sophie, yeah, I'm afraid you're going to have to come up here, love.
Given how difficult it is being a writer, what made both of you want to be one? It's not exactly the easiest job.
I don't think I could contemplate a time when I didn't want to write. The Amulet of Kings, the first book I had published about nearly 5 years ago now. The first draft of that I actually wrote in my very early 20s. And I'd written other stuff since. I think at the end of it, it's not just that. As I said earlier, the job of writers is to entertain. Not just to educate, but to entertain. And I've always wanted to entertain. But I can't sing, and I can't dance, and my jokes aren't always very good. So writing is an acceptable substitute for me.
Very, very similar. I mean, I wrote my first book when I was 7. It was about a knight who killed a dragon and then found an egg and took it home. And it hatched into a little dragon, and he became his friend and followed him everywhere. I think it ran to about 8 pages, and I stapled it and drew a picture of a dragon on the front. It was brilliant. I should dig that out, actually. But yeah, the same thing, and all just for some reason, it was something I always kind of assumed I was, so never really questioned it. Found out I was fundamentally unsuited to most other types of employment, and then so eventually decided to do what I loved rather than doing all the things I hated.
I remember once for an English assignment at school, I filled about half a notebook with this story. I mean, I've actually got the structure and characters and all that sort of stuff, and the English master, who was expecting like 2 or 3 pages of creative writing, gave it back to me and said it was very impressive, and he'd put a tick on every page to prove that he'd read it all. Only half of the pages were ticked. Has anybody else got any questions? Does anybody have any announcements? Pete, nothing much happening with the Festival of Literature yet. Oh. Joe. Yeah, Joe's always got announcements. Right. No. I mean, when is the next Fringe, Joe?
The next Fringe is March 21st, and Pete and my family Rodman are going to be reading. The Fringe after that, in April, I believe it's the 16th of April, is an open mic. So if everybody wants to bring stuff, and we will do 5-minute readings and buzz you off, which was enormous fun every time we do it. So we're planning that for April. And then in May, we've got Paul Cornell. So that'd be nice. Other things. Fight Like a Girl. If you're planning to come to the Fight Like a Girl launch and you want to buy buffet food, you need to let me know, or you need to let Sammy know before the 15th of March so that I can tell the Hatchet how much food we need. There's an Eventbrite site for it, or it's on Facebook. You can turn up without buying food, but if you want food, you need to buy food in advance, and that is £5.95. So it's a fiver for the buffet, and then 95p for the Eventbrite fee. I think that's it. Oh, next week in here is pub night, if anyone wants to come to pub night.
Somebody else is going to have to be in charge of the microphone for next month's Fringe, because I'm going to be in Canada. At least I hope I'm going to be in Canada, always assuming that they let me through the border, which you never can tell these days. So we need to sort out something about that. For the Fight Like a Girl thing, this probably only applies to Jonathan and myself, but the railway line between Bath and Bristol is going to be down that week. There will be replacement bus services, so it takes 50 minutes rather than 10 for the journey. So I might actually like come up the night before and stay with a friend or something like that. I don't think I have any announcements, because all the exciting stuff I was doing has just finished. That's why I'm so tired. Other than that, I'm going to Canada, and I'll probably take I'll see if they need any more airships, and maybe take a couple of Colin hardcovers over or something like that. There are boxes of books. What are these boxes of books, Joe? Are you going to tell us?
These are boxes of books that Pete brought back that were left over from What's Your Game in Gloucester. There's some of my books in there. There's some Sophie's. There's some hardback Airships and some Colin books. If anyone wants to buy one, then hit me up when this finishes, but fairly quickly because I need to take my dog home because she's passed out.
If she's passed out, you don't have to take her anywhere. Just leave her.
And of course, never missing an opportunity, I did bring a few books with me. So if anyone fancies one, they can see me later on.
Alrighty. So basically, the word is buy books. And failing all else, come back here for Pub Night next week or for Fringe on March the 21st. Fabulous. Thank you very much, people.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.